Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
But tonight, we're not going to be talking very much about St. Thomas. Right at the end, I'll squeeze a little bit in, if there's time. But it's certainly sort of in the vicinity of things that St. Thomas would care about and value. C.S. Lewis is the main thinker that we'll be considering tonight, as the title suggests. And when I talk about ethics of technology, the emphasis for me is on the ethics side. And that's mostly because of my own training. I'm not a technologist. I'm not a techie person. I won't be able to give you very specific insights into specific kinds of technology. There are questions about, say, medical ethics or engineering ethics that I think that one would actually need quite a bit of subject-specific knowledge to make really insightful claims or answer really hard questions within certain subfields of tech ethics. So we're going to be staying at a certain level of generality, not superficiality, but generality, so that we can, so to speak, take lots of forms of technology into account at once and hopefully offer all of you, whatever your own backgrounds are or whatever your goals are, offer all of you something to think about, both in your production of technologies, if you're in those fields, but especially in your consumption of them, which will be more of the focus toward the end of the talk. All right, so Lewis here is a familiar name to most of us. I think it's pretty rare for someone never to have heard of C.S. Lewis in college. It's pretty common for students to have read at least one of the Chronicles of Narnia, usually The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He is famous, not as famous as he is for his Narnia books, but famous as a Christian apologist. His Mere Christianity has sold millions of copies, has influenced many, many people. My own personal relationship, as it were, with C.S. Lewis began when an aunt of mine gave me a stack of books by C.S. Lewis as I was recovering from a broken leg in high school. And she herself had been led to Christian faith by reading Mere Christianity. And I know that many, many people, probably thousands, could say the same thing. He wrote, with the exception of his purely scholarly work, which won't come into this talk at all, almost all of his nonfiction had something to do with the Christian faith. If you think about Miracles, his book Miracles, his book The Problem of Pain. But the book that we'll be talking about tonight doesn't have anything on the surface to do with God. It is Lewis's least theological book, but I think sort of suggests or opens us up to questions of faith. But Lewis wrote this book, The Abolition of Man, briefly described on the handout, originally as a set of lectures. He was concerned about what we might call the loss of moral knowledge, the widespread and growing, in his time, belief that concerning value, moral value, aesthetic value. There could be no such thing as knowledge because any sorts of judgments about value were merely expressions of feelings. And so he gave these lectures that together are published as The Abolition of Man as a kind of defense, a broad defense of the doctrine of objective value, as he describes it in the first chapter, against this pernicious philosophy that denies that value is a real feature of our world. But in the third chapter, the third and final chapter of this short little book, Lewis offers a kind of prophecy. He says, what if this emotivist philosophy that denies all value, what if that sort of philosophy were combined with a technocracy that had pervasive control over who gets to be born and what their genetic makeup will be like? He tries to imagine a scenario in which human beings gain total control over the outcomes of new human life, and wonders if we don't have the right sorts of values, what horrible consequences might there be with the conjunction of those two, the certain technocratic apex combined with the denial of objective morality. So we'll be considering together this sort of prophecy from chapter 3, and then I would like to explicate it for you, encourage you to go and read it on your own at some point. But then once we've done that, I would like to make some applications to our own day. My guess is that as we go along, the applications to our own situation will suggest themselves to you. But I will mention a few, and then I hope that in our Q&A time, we can that I can hear from you about things that Lewis and the talk are making you think about, and maybe we can discuss things together and make some progress that way. So we could think of technology. Again, I mentioned that we're going to stay at a high level of generality. All right, so we are rational animals. We are not well endowed with physiological weapons or insulation. And so we're born naked, we stay naked. Well, then we make clothes. We can't run very fast. We don't have sharp claws. We don't have any venom, except in our words. So in that regard, we are ill-equipped by nature. But we're rational, and our rationality equips us to make things and to use things. To use some of the things we make, to use some found objects in nature in order to overcome some of these limitations imposed simply by the kind of thing that we are. So we can make clothes, we can learn to gather and produce food much more efficiently. Coming into the closer to the present, we have transportation and communications technologies which make the burdens of distance and communication less onerous, and so on and so forth. So we can think of technology perhaps in this very general sense as anything that we use or make in order to overcome the limitations imposed by our human nature. In Lewis's Abolition of Man, he highlights the common expression, I think less commonly used now, but one that we've all heard before. This expression that technology or science is all about the conquest of nature. The conquest of nature. And he's interested in that sort of attitude, which he claims goes back to the rise of modern science in people like Francis Bacon. But he grants whatever sort of pernicious themes might be lurking in the background of that sort of rhetoric, man's conquest of nature. He grants that there is a straightforward sense in which, through our technology, we do overcome, and in that sense, conquer limitations imposed by nature. So there really is a straightforward, neutral sense in which we can think of technologies in general as a way of controlling or conquering or overcoming nature in some respect or other. He actually gives us three specific examples, which will seem a little quaint. He was writing in the 1940s. He asks us to consider the airplane, the radio, he calls it the wireless, because that's what they did back then, and artificial contraception. And in each case, he notes the obvious ways in which these overcome certain kinds of limitations. Airplanes overcome limitations of distance that keep people apart, blah, blah, blah. Radio overcomes also limitations of distance, but in communication, but also it overcomes another sort of limitation, which is that without something like radio technology or more modern communication technologies, it's very hard to speak to millions or perhaps billions of people at once. The human voice can't do that. So we overcome the limitation of natural audience when we introduce these new communication technologies. And in artificial contraception, I think, well, what's the limitation overcome there? Well, you know, in an obvious way, we are disconnecting the pleasures of sex from its natural procreative outcome, and there's something wrong with that. But maybe even more darkly, we can think of artificial contraception as overcoming the burden or the limitations of pregnancy and children. We get to pick when these little guys come into the world. On our own terms, when we are ready for them. And insofar as marital life without artificial contraception is a kind of openness to be surprised, then you might think of the burdens of pregnancy and parenthood. The burden that a child is one of the burdens or limitations that is overcome by this particular reproductive technology. Incidentally, and this is the 1940s, and so Lewis couldn't have been thinking about the pill. He was probably thinking of rubber condoms, which once they were able to mass produce them with rubber, the use of them became much more widespread in the first half of the 20th century. So we can, and then you could start generalizing. You know, pick any sort of more modern technology. You can start thinking for yourself about ways in which it's overcoming some sort of aspect of nature. All right, so technology gives us power over nature. But here's the other thing technology does, and I think this is one of the most important insights of Lewis's in this book, that in addition to giving man power over nature, technology also gives some men power over other men. Some people power over other people. Whether you think of the inventor of the technology or the purchaser of the technology, whoever has the control of it has power. With an airplane, you can have power by only letting people ride your airplane if they give you a lot of money. So then if they want to participate in the overcoming of distance, you have this power over them that you get some of their money. But another way that having an airplane gives you power over some people is that you can drop bombs on them. And for any technology, we can think about ways in which it equips, even if it's in relatively harmless ways, any technology gives those who control it power over other people. And that was the insight the first time I went through the abolition of man that started making me a little uncomfortable as I was reading this third and final chapter. So I hope it makes you a little uncomfortable too, in a good way, for a good end. So now extrapolate from this idea of technology as giving some people power over other people, and imagine, and here we begin the prophecy. Imagine, and Lewis actually maybe is a little bit naive. He says, imagine 100 centuries hence. But maybe it's more like 100 years. Sufficiently powerful technology that might give some people total control over other people. Total control. How might this happen? He's thinking here of eugenics. And he's thinking about psychological techniques of manipulating or brainwashing. He thinks that it is plausible, not in his own day, but plausible that with a sufficiently advanced eugenics program and sufficiently reliable psychological techniques, you could totally dominate a class of human beings, make them have the physiological characteristics you want them to have, make them have the personality dispositions you want them to have, even perhaps make them have the very beliefs you want them to have. Total control. Is this possible? Not in 1943, not now, but based on what you know about what's going on, gene editing, IVF, is it completely out of the realm of possibility? Perhaps God would never let it happen, but is it out of the realm of possibility that some people might think this would be a good thing to do? Now, not, of course, to apply these new techniques over existing human beings, but this would have to be something that we apply to potential human beings, right? Where we start messing with embryos and producing these new post-human organisms that are fully customized post-human organisms. Is that within the realm of possibility? It certainly is within the realm of desire of many people who are so-called techno-optimists. The vast majority of human beings in this doomsday sort of prophecy, the vast majority of human beings are brought into the world as these fully customized post-human organisms, brought into this the world by those lucky or perhaps unlucky few who have the control of the relevant technologies. He calls these the conditioners. And so these poor souls that the conditioners have control over, we can call them the conditioned. What is the abolition of man? Well, to abolish something, to get rid of it. So the abolition of man here is that these post-human organisms will have, in their embryonic state, will have become merely the raw materials for a kind of artifact. We're no longer treating new human life as new human beings with their own life trajectory, but we're treating them as the kind of raw materials that we could just do stuff with. The way that you gather some timber and make a house, you gather some human genetic material and you make a kind of human. So the abolition of man is accomplished when the vast majority of young human life is treated as an artifact. It's treated as raw material for the production of an artifact. And that's pretty horrible. That would be really horrible. Someone told me that I really need to see a movie called Gattaca. And maybe some of you have seen it, and feel free to bring it up in Q&A. I haven't seen the movie because I don't watch very many movies. I'm not anti-movie. I've 6 kids. I don't have time. We watched, what did we watch? We watched Cinderella. But the newer one, I thought it was pretty good. But that's sort of the cultural level I'm at when it comes to film. So if you want to say something about this thing called Gattaca, feel free to do that in Q&A. Okay, so that is abolition of man number one. That the conditioners gain so much control over the kinds of things we will become that it ceases to make sense to call us human beings. We're just artifacts. But there's a second abolition, and in some ways it's even worse. And whether or not you think it's worse, I think it actually yields some of the deeper philosophical insights of abolition of man. And so I want to focus on that second abolition for the rest of the talk. Remember the scenario at the beginning. Lewis is asking us to imagine a situation in which human beings have thrown off the shackles of traditional morality. They have recognized, discovered that there are no such things as objective moral facts, are no such things as objective values whatsoever. Of course, there is no God. And so what could possibly constrain their decision-making about how to treat these human embryos? Right, what could constrain them? They no longer feel themselves bound by morality, so how will they decide? Well, the insight of Lewis is that they will decide based on their desires. It will be how they want the human race to be. Whatever they want, that's how it will be, because they have the technology to bring about what they want. They won't attend to something like a moral principle. They won't consult a realm of moral value. They will do what they want. Even the idea what they think is best doesn't quite make sense here, because to do what you think is best or to do what you think is good either means that you are in touch with some sort of standard that you are trying to bring about through the action, the good. Or by the good, you just mean what you want. But ex hypothesi, these conditioners have rejected the idea that there are objective goods. So all they have to go on, so to speak, all that they will be controlled by in their decision making is whatever they happen to want. There's that don't die guy, Brian Johnson, who's heard, yeah, some of you are here. Yeah, so he's really into not dying. Yeah. And so far he's really good at it. He's like 100% alive right now. But he has a viral clip, he has lots of viral clips. He's had his own son's blood infused into his body. He's had weirder things. But he was commenting on the way in which morality is a kind of, it doesn't really make sense anymore in our new age, this sort of transhumanist or post-human age. If we really want to have limitless life, we need to have, and he literally used these words, a total blank slate when it comes to values, to take nothing for granted that has been taken for granted by our ancestors. It's literally the posture in which the conditioners would find themselves. You throw off everything else and you just sort of reach forward to a future where you just really don't want to die. And that will be that desire will be the only thing governing your decision making. But back to the conditioners, who are not just trying not to die, but who are trying to program, so to speak, the human race forever. Right? Because once you've achieved this sort of total control over who will live and how they will live, you've become the master, not just of those people, but of the entire human race or post-human race that follows. So this is a big decision. Too bad they've given up on morality. But if they had retained morality, they wouldn't be trying to do that in the first place. The fact that many people think that reprogramming or editing human beings is a good thing, that we could do that sort of engineering work on little human lives. If you're that sort of person, probably you don't feel too bound by morality. In focusing on the fact of mere desire as the controlling attitude for these conditioners, Lewis notes that our desires, and I think this is right, our desires, often we have very little control over them. And think here of like basic urges, like when you feel hunger and you have the desire to eat. If you have virtue or self-discipline, you might be able to feel that desire and not immediately act on it. But the fact that you feel that desire is not really under your control. Now, in the tradition of virtue ethics, there is a kind of promise that over long habituation to virtue, we do get a kind of directing of our desires toward the good. But in general, I think Lewis's point stands that so many of our desires, our mere desires, aren't in our control. And when we feel a desire and don't act on it, why is that? It's because we say to ourselves, well, yeah, I feel that, but that's not the good thing to do right now. And we all have this capacity, even if we're not particularly virtuous. If like right now you feel a little bit hungry and you're looking at the chips, you know, and you think, well, maybe I could just walk down and just get these sour cream and onion chips and I could open the bag and then I could crunch them. That would make me so happy. So you have the desire for the chips, but you're not doing that because you have basic manners, and that would be a pretty rude thing to do in the middle of a lecture. So your recognition of the relevant values, don't be rude to your guest, right, helps you block or not act on that desire that has suddenly sort of popped into your head or your tummy. But if you reject all value, you can't check your desires. Your desires, in fact, you will see as having the only authorization that is available to you. So the new masters of the human race, the conditioners, they are technocrats in the extreme. Technology is a sort of power over nature. So they've gained that power over nature, over human nature itself. But all of their decision-making about how to exercise that power is prompted by desires over which the conditioners themselves have hardly any control. So Lewis describes this as a great irony. And this is the quotation, famous quotation on the handout. I'll read it. I know you have it in front of you, but it's worth reading out loud. At the moment, then, of man's victory over nature, we find the whole human race subjected to some individual men, and those individuals subjected to that in themselves which is purely natural to their, to their irrational impulses. Nature, untrammeled by values, rules the conditioners, and through them, all humanity. Man's conquest of nature turns out in the moment of its consummation to be nature's conquest of man. This sort of return of the conditioners to basically an animal state. So technologically super advanced, you need to be rational to achieve that level of technological prowess. But in every other respect, reason has failed. And more, their behavior is animalistic. And this is the sense in which they, in setting out to conquer nature, are themselves conquered by nature. Okay, so we can draw a couple of lessons here. Obviously, we can think about the fact that in our use of technology and our development of technologies, we cannot do this in a value-neutral way. And if you are involved in these fields and you take your requisite engineering ethics class or whatever, probably it will be something like compliance, how not to get sued. So you're going to have to go beyond the required tech ethics requirement. Do not think of ethics in your disciplines if you are in STEM fields. Do not think of ethics as compliance. And if there aren't professionals in your field able to offer that, do your own reading. There's this guy named St. Thomas Aquinas who has a lot of good stuff on ethics. All right, but then I think there's a more important lesson than just let's make sure we're not value neutral in our development and use of technology. I think that Lewis is really getting onto something important about what it is that makes us human beings. What are we? Well, of course, we're rational animals. Okay. But in the vision of the conditioners, we have a picture of rationality in one way operating in a very high level, but in this other, more important way, being almost atrophied. And that suggests that our rational animality is not meant to be expressed in a sort of technological prowess, but in some deeper way. What is that deeper way? It's not primarily our tech abilities. I think it's our ability to apprehend value and then to apply our rationality in such a way that our apprehension of values governs our thinking and our acting. And it's that use of reason in particular that is distinctively human, that ability, so to speak, to step back from the flow of desires, the flow of sensory inputs, to step back and say, but what is the good thing to do? Not, what do I really feel like doing right now? But what is the good thing to do? Is this good for me? Is this thing I want to do, will it hurt someone else? We can step back. And when we do that reflecting work, we are apprehending value. We're trying to think about the good and how that fits into our circumstances here and now. This is called practical reasoning. So it's not just our theoretical reason, so to speak, in which our humanity consists. It's our ability to reason practically. That is, apprehending values and applying them in concrete circumstances here and now. And so there's this paradox that we really are at our, we achieve our best sort of humanity and are at our most free, least conquered by nature, at our most free when we place ourselves under authority. In this case, under the authority of morality. Now, many of us, perhaps most of us in this room might think, also under some other authority, right? And here's the God stuff. Ultimately, Lewis thinks that morality leads us to God. And he talks about this sort of argument in his book, Mere Christianity. But in The Abolition of Man, he doesn't go there. And I think probably it's a prudential call of his to try to reach as many people as possible. He's trying to warn not only theists, but atheists alike. And so you can think of it as a sort of, well, hey, look, you got to hold on to virtue, right? You got to hold on to value, right? You're not going to give that up, right? It's like, okay, well, now look where that takes you. Okay. So there is a theological payoff to this, but in the book itself, that's not Lewis's primary goal. So to recognize, to retain our humanity in our current era, we must recognize what we are and act accordingly, not technicians first and foremost, but rational animals who can judge their desires by the standards of value written into the natural law. We're not passive servants of the technocracy or any particular device they give us. We are not servants of these things or them, but free agents made to apply our rationality to the activity of living well. I won't discuss the Joseph Fasano poem, though I do recommend that you read it. It's on the handout, and perhaps meditate on it. This line, "What are you trying to be free of?" The living, the miraculous task of it. He wrote this in response to a student who had used ChatGPT on an assignment. And so he was reflecting about that. You know, what are we going to save for ourselves to do? If we give everything over, we are allowing ourselves to be conditioned. So I think the danger that Lewis forecasts is real, but he also offers help to avoid it. And for further reading, if you have not already, I do recommend a slow read through Abolition of Man. Thanks for your attention, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.